They left their arms in the courtyard and began to file out with lowered heads. One of them turned when he reached the door. "I'm staying with you, compañero president," he said. By mid-morning, it was clear that dialogue would not resolve the situation, and almost everyone began to leave. Only close friends and the private guard remained behind. The president had to order his daughters to leave. They had to be removed forcibly, and they could be heard from the street calling his name. Some 30 people were left in the building, holding out in the drawing rooms on the second floor. Among them was Jaime, feeling as if he were in the middle of a nightmare. He sat down on a red velvet chair with a gun in his hand, staring at it blankly. He did not know how to use it. It seemed to him that time was moving very slowly. His watch showed that only 3 hours of this bad dream had passed. He heard the voice of the president speaking to the nation on the radio. It was his farewell. "I speak to all those who will be persecuted to tell you that I am not going to resign. I will repay the people's loyalty with my life. I will always be with you. I have faith in our nation and its destiny. Other men will prevail, and soon the great avenues will be open again, where free men will walk to build a better society. Long live the people! Long live the workers! These are my last words. I know my sacrifice will not have been in vain." The sky began to cloud. Isolated gunshots were heard in the distance. At that moment, the president was speaking on the phone with the head of the uprising, who was offering a military plane to leave the country with his family. But he was not the kind of man to become an exile in some distant place where he would spend the rest of his life vegetating with other deposed leaders who had left their countries on a moment's notice. "You were wrong about me, traitors. The people put me here, and the only way I'll leave is dead," he replied serenely. Then came the roar of the airplanes, and the bombing began. Jaime threw himself to the floor with everyone else, unable to believe what he was seeing. Until the day before, he had been convinced that nothing like this would ever happen in his country, and that even the military respected the law. Only the president was on his feet. He walked to the window carrying a bazooka and fired it at the tanks below. Jaime inched his way to him and grabbed him by the calves to make him get down. But the president replied with a curse and remained erect. 15 minutes later, the whole building was in flames, and it was impossible to breathe because of the bombs and the smoke. Jaime crawled among the broken furniture and bits of plaster that were falling around him like a deadly rain, attempting to help the wounded, but he could only offer words of comfort and close the eyes of the dead. In a sudden pause in the shooting, the president gathered the survivors and told them to leave because he did not want any martyrs or needless sacrifice. Everyone had a family, and important tasks lay ahead. "I'm going to call a truce so you can leave," he added, but no one moved. Though a few of them were trembling, all were in apparent possession of their dignity. The bombing was brief, but it left the palace in ruins. By 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the fire had consumed the old drawing rooms that had been used since colonial times, and only a handful of men were left around the president. Soldiers entered the building and took what was left of the first floor. Above the din was heard the hysterical voice of an officer ordering them to surrender and come down single file with their hands on their heads. The president shook each of them by the hand. "I'll go last," he said. They never again saw him alive. Jaime went downstairs with the others. Soldiers had been stationed on each step of the broad stone staircase. They seemed to have lost their senses. They kicked and beat those coming down the stairs with the butts of their guns, as if possessed by a new hatred that had just been invented and had bloomed in them in the space of a few hours. A few of them fired their guns over the heads of those who had surrendered. Jaime received a blow to his stomach that made him double up in pain, and when he was able to stand, his eyes were full of tears and his pants moist with excrement. The soldiers continued to beat them all the way into the street, where they were ordered to lie face down on the ground. There they were trampled on and insulted until there were no more Spanish curse words left. Then someone motioned to one of the tanks. The prisoners heard it approach, shaking the pavement with its weight like an invincible pachyderm.
"Make way! We're going to run the tank over these bastards," a colonel shouted.
Jaime looked up from the ground and thought he recognized the man. He reminded him of a boy he used to play with at Tres Marias when he was a child. The tank snorted past, 4 inches from their heads, amidst the hard laughter of the soldiers and the howl of the fire engines. In the distance, they could hear the sound of warplanes. A long while later, they divided the prisoners into groups according to their guilt. Jaime was taken to the Ministry of Defense, which had been transformed into a barracks. They made him walk in a squatting position, as if he were in a trench, and led him into an enormous room filled with naked men who had been tied up in lines of 10, their hands bound behind their backs, so badly beaten that some could hardly stand. Rivulets of blood were running down onto the marble floor. Jaime was led into the boiler room, where other men were lined up against the wall beneath the watchful eye of a pale soldier who kept his machine gun trained on them. There he stood motionless for a long time, managing to stay erect as if he were sleepwalking, still not understanding what was happening and tormented by the screams coming through the walls. He noticed that the soldier was watching him. Suddenly the man lowered his gun and came up to him.
"Sit down and rest, doctor. But if I tell you to, stand up immediately," he said softly, handing him a lighted cigarette. "You operated on my mother and saved her life."
Jaime did not smoke, but he savored that cigarette, inhaling as slowly as he could. His watch was destroyed, but his hunger and thirst led him to believe that it was night. He was so tired and uncomfortable in his stained trousers that he did not even wonder what was going to happen to him. His head was beginning to nod when the soldier came over to him again.
"Get up, doctor," he whispered. "They're coming for you now. Good luck."
A moment later, two men walked in, handcuffed him, and led him before an officer who was in charge of interrogating the prisoners. Jaime had seen him on occasion in the company of the president.
"We know you have nothing to do with this, doctor," he said. "We just want you to appear on television and say that the president was drunk and he committed suicide. After that, you can go home."
"Do it yourself."
"Don't count on me, you bastards," Jaime said.
They held him down by the arms. The first blow was to his stomach. After that, they picked him up and smashed him down on the table. He felt them remove his clothes. Much later, they carried him, unconscious, from the Ministry of Defense. It had begun to rain, and the freshness of the water and the air revived him. He awoke as they were loading him onto an army bus and sat him down in the last seat. He saw the night through the window, and when the vehicle began to move, he could see the empty streets and flag-decked buildings. He understood that the enemy had won, and he probably thought about Miguel. The bus pulled into the courtyard of a military regiment. They took him off the bus. There were other prisoners in the same condition. They tied their hands and feet with barbed wire and threw them on their faces in the stalls. There, Jaime and the others spent 2 days without food or water, rotting in their own excrement, blood, and fear, until they were all driven by truck to an area near the airport. In an empty lot, they were shot on the ground because they could no longer stand, and then their bodies were dynamited. The shock of the explosion and the stench of the remains floated in the air for a long time. In the big house on the corner, Senator Trueba opened a bottle of French champagne to celebrate the overthrow of the regime that he had fought against so ferociously, never suspecting that at that very moment his son Jaime's testicles were being burned with an imported cigarette. The old man hung a flag over the entrance of his house and did not go outside to dance because he was lame and because there was a curfew, but not because he did not want to, as he jubilantly announced to his daughter and granddaughter. Meanwhile, hanging on to the telephone, Alba was attempting to get word on those she was most worried about: Miguel, Pedro III, her uncle Jaime, Amanda, Sebastián Gómez, and so many others. "Now they're going to pay for everything," Senator Treba exclaimed, raising his glass. Alba snatched it from his hand and hurled it against the wall, shattering it to bits. Blanca, who had never had the courage to oppose her father, did not attempt to hide her smile. "We're not going to celebrate the death of the president or anybody else," Alba said. In the pristine houses of the High District, bottles that had waited for 3 years were opened, and the new order was toasted. All that night, helicopters flew over the working-class neighborhoods, humming like flies from another world. Very late, almost at dawn, the phone rang. Alba, who had not gone to bed, ran to answer it. She was relieved to hear Miguel. "The time has come, my love. Don't look for me or wait for me. I love you," he said.
"Miguel, I want to go with you," Alba cried.
"Don't mention me to anybody, Alba. Don't see any of our friends. Destroy all your address books, your papers, anything that has to do with me. I'll always love you. Remember that, my love," Miguel said, and he hung up. The curfew lasted for 2 days, which to Alba seemed an eternity. On the radio, they played martial music, and on television, they showed only landscapes from around the country and cartoons. Several times a day, the four generals of the junta appeared on the screen, seated between the coat of arms and the flag, to announce various edicts. They were the new heroes of the nation. Despite the order to shoot anyone who ventured outside, Senator Treba crossed the street to attend a celebration in his neighbor's house. The hubbub of the party did not concern the soldiers patrolling the streets, because it was a neighborhood where they expected no opposition. Blanca announced that she had the worst migraine of her life and locked herself in her room. During the night, Alba heard her rummaging in the kitchen and concluded that her mother's hunger must have overcome her headache. Alba spent 2 days walking around the house in circles in a state of sheer despair, going through the books in Jaime's tunnel and on her own shelves and destroying anything that might be compromising. It was like a sacrilege. She was sure that when her uncle returned, he would be furious with her and lose all trust in her. She also destroyed the address books with her friends' phone numbers, her most treasured love letters, and even her photographs of Miguel. Indifferent and bored, the maids entertained themselves throughout the curfew by making empanadas, all, that is, except the cook, who wept nonstop and anxiously awaited the moment when she would be able to go out and join her husband, with whom she had been unable to communicate. When the curfew was lifted for a few hours to enable people to go out and buy food, Blanca was amazed to see the stores filled with the products that during the preceding 3 years had been so scarce and that now appeared in the shop windows as if by magic. She saw piles of butchered chickens and was able to buy as many as she wanted, even though they cost 3 times as much as usual, since free pricing had been decreed. She noticed many people staring curiously at the chickens as if they had never seen them before, but few were buying because they could not afford them. 3 days later, the smell of rotting meat infected every shop in the city. Soldiers nervously patrolled the streets, cheered by many people who had wished for the government's defeat. Some of them, emboldened by the violence of the past few days, stopped all men with long hair or beards, unequivocal signs of a rebel spirit, and all women dressed in slacks, which they cut to ribbons because they felt responsible for imposing order, morality, and decency. The new authorities announced that they had nothing to do with actions of this sort and had never given orders to cut beards or slacks, and that it was probably the work of communists disguised as soldiers attempting to cast aspersions on the armed forces and make the citizenry hate them. Neither beards nor slacks were forbidden, they said, although of course they preferred men to shave and wear their hair short, and women to wear dresses. Word spread that the president had died, and no one believed the official version that he had committed suicide.
I waited until things had stabilized a little. 3 days after the military pronunciamiento, I drove to the Ministry of Defense in my congressional car, surprised that no one had come to invite me to participate in the new government. Everyone knows I was the Marxist chief enemy, the first to oppose communist dictatorship and to dare say in public that only the military could prevent the country from falling into the clutches of the left. I was also the one who made almost all the contacts with the high command of the military, who was the intermediary with the gringos, and who used my own name and money to buy arms. In other words, I had more at stake than anyone. At my age, I was not interested in political power, but I was one of the few people around who could advise them, because I'd held many posts over the years and I knew better than anyone what this country needed. What could a bunch of temporary colonels do without loyal, honest, experienced advisers? Just make a mess of things. Or be deceived by those sharp characters who know how to turn this kind of situation into personal profit. Something that's already happening. No one knew then that things were going to turn out the way they have. We thought military intervention was a necessary step for the return to a healthy democracy. That's why I thought it was so important to cooperate with the authorities. When I arrived at the Ministry of Defense, I was surprised to see that the building had become a pigsty. Orderlies were swabbing the floors with mops. Some of the walls were riddled with bullet holes, and crouched soldiers were running around as if they were in the middle of a battlefield or expected the enemy to drop from the roof. I had to wait nearly 3 hours to see an officer. At first, I thought that in all that chaos, they simply hadn't recognized me, and that was why they were treating me with so little respect. But then, I realized what was going on. The officer received me with his boots up on the desk, chewing a greasy sandwich, badly shaven, with his jacket unbuttoned. He didn't give me a chance to ask about my son Jaime or to congratulate him for the valiant actions of the soldiers who had saved the nation. Instead, he asked for the keys to my car, on the ground that Congress had been shut down and that all congressional prerequisites had therefore been suspended. I was amazed. It was clear then that they didn't have the slightest intention of reopening the doors of Congress, as we all expected. He asked me, no, he ordered me, to show up at the cathedral at 11 the next morning to attend the Te Deum, with which the nation would express its gratitude to God for the victory over communism. Is it true the president committed suicide? I asked. He's gone, he answered me. Gone? Where to? He's gone to hell, he said, laughing. I walked out onto the street feeling extremely disconcerted, leaning on my chauffeur's arm. We had no way to get home. There were neither taxis nor buses, and I'm too old to walk. Fortunately, we saw a jeep full of policemen, and they recognized me. I'm easy to spot, as my granddaughter Alba says, because I have the unmistakable appearance of an angry old crow, and I always wear my morning clothes and carry my silver cane. "Get in, Senator," a lieutenant said. They helped us up into the jeep. The men looked tired, and I could tell they hadn't slept. They told me they had been patrolling the city for the past 3 days, staying awake on coffee and pills. "Did you meet any resistance in the shanty towns or slums?" I asked. "Very little. People are calm," the lieutenant said. "I hope things get back to normal quickly, Senator. We don't like this. It's a dirty business." "Don't say that. If you people hadn't acted, The communists would have staged a coup themselves, and right this minute all of us here plus another 50,000 people would be dead. I suppose you knew they had a plan for imposing their dictatorship? That's what they told us. But where I live, they've arrested a lot of people. My neighbors look at me with fear. The same thing happens to the rest of my men. But you have to follow orders. The nation comes first, right? That's the way it is. I'm also sorry about what's going on, Lieutenant, but there was no other way. The regime was rotten. What would have happened to this country if you people hadn't taken up your arms? But deep down, I wasn't so sure. I had a feeling things weren't turning out the way we had planned and that the situation was slipping away from me. But at the time, I kept my doubts to myself, reasoning that 3 days are very few to put a country back together, and that probably the vulgar officer who received me at the Ministry of Defense represented an insignificant minority within the armed forces. The majority were like the scrupulous lieutenant who had driven me home. I supposed that in no time at all order would be restored, and that once the tension of the first few days had ebbed, I would get in touch with someone better placed within the military hierarchy. I regretted not having spoken to General Hurtado. I held off out of respect, and also, I must admit, out of pride, because he should have sought me out, and not vice versa. I didn't learn of my son Jaime's death until 2 weeks later, after our euphoria over the triumph had waned when we saw people going around counting the dead and those who had disappeared. One Sunday, a soldier silently appeared at the house and went into the kitchen to tell Blanca everything he had seen in the Ministry of Defense and what he knew about the dynamited bodies. "Dr. Del Valle saved my mother's life," the soldier said, looking at the floor, his helmet in his hand. "That's why I came to tell you how they killed him." Blanca called me in so I could hear what the soldier had to say, but I refused to believe it. I said he must have been confused, that it couldn't have been Jaime but someone else he had seen in the boiler room, because Jaime had no reason to be in the presidential palace the day of the military pronunciamiento. I was sure my son had managed to escape abroad by crossing some border pass or had taken refuge in some embassy, on the assumption that he was being looked for. Besides, his name had not appeared on any of the lists of people sought by the authorities, so I deduced that Jaime had nothing to fear. A long time would have to pass, several months, in fact, before I understood that the soldier had told the truth. In my deluded solitude, I sat waiting for my son in the armchair of my library, my eyes glued to the door sill, calling to him with my mind, as I used to call for Clara. I called him so many times that I finally saw him. But when he came, he was covered with dried blood and rags, dragging streamers of barbed wire across the waxed parquet floors. That was how I learned that he had died exactly as the soldier reported. Only then did I begin to speak of tyranny. My granddaughter Alba, however, saw the true nature of the dictator long before I did. She picked him out from among all the generals and military men. She recognized him right away, because she had inherited Clara's intuition. He's a crude, simple-looking man of few words, like a peasant. He seemed very modest, and few could have guessed that one day they would see him wrapped in an emperor's cape, with his arms raised to hush the crowds that had been trucked in to acclaim him, his august mustache trembling with vanity as he inaugurated the monument to the four swords, from whose height an eternal torch would illuminate the nation's destiny, except that, owing to an error by the foreign technicians, no flame would ever rise there, only a thick cloud of kitchen smoke that floated in the sky like a perennial storm from some other climate. I began to think I had been wrong to do as I had, and that perhaps, after all, this was not the best way to overthrow Marxism. I felt more and more alone, for no one needed me anymore. I no longer had my sons, and Clara, with her habits of silence and distraction, seemed like a far-off ghost. Even Alba grew daily more remote. I hardly ever saw her in the house. She went by me like a gust of wind in her horrible long cotton skirts with her incredible green hair like Rosa's, busy in all sorts of mysterious chores that she carried out with the complicity of her mother. I'm sure that behind my back the two of them were weaving every kind of intrigue. My granddaughter was in a state, just like Clara in the days of the typhus epidemic, when she took everybody else's suffering onto her own back.
Alba did not have long to mourn her Uncle Jaime's death. The needs of others were so pressing that she was forced to put her grief aside for later. She did not see Miguel again until 2 months after the coup, and she began to fear that he too was dead. Still, she did not look for him. He had given her strict instructions in that regard, and besides, she had heard that his name was on the lists of those who had been ordered to appear before the new authorities. That gave her hope. As long as they're looking for him, he's still alive, she concluded. She tortured herself with the idea that they might capture him alive, and invoked the spirit of her grandmother to ask her to prevent that from happening. "I'd rather see him dead 1,000 times over, grandmother," she begged. She knew what was taking place in the country, which was why she walked around with knots in her stomach, why her hands shook, and why, whenever she heard that someone had been taken prisoner, she broke out in a rash from head to foot, like someone with the plague. But there was no one with whom she could speak about these things, not even her grandfather, because people preferred not to know. After that terrible Tuesday, Alba had to rearrange her feelings in order to continue living, to accept the idea that she would never again see those she loved the most, her Uncle Jaime, Miguel, and many others. She blamed her grandfather for what had taken place, but then, seeing him hunched in his armchair, calling out to Clara and his son in an interminable murmur, her love for the old man returned, and she ran to embrace him, running her hands through his white hair and comforting him. She felt that everything was made of glass, as fragile as a sigh, and that the machine gun fire and the bombs of that unforgettable Tuesday had destroyed most of what she knew, and that all the rest had been smashed to pieces and spattered with blood. As days, weeks, and months went by, what had first appeared to be spared also began to show signs of destruction. She noticed that friends and relatives were avoiding her. Some crossed the street so as not to say hello to her, or turned away when she drew near. She imagined the word had spread that she was helping the victims of the persecution. And it was true. From the very first days, the most pressing need was to secure asylum for those in danger of death. At first, it almost seemed like fun, because it kept her from thinking of Miguel. But Alba soon realized it was no game. Everywhere there were posters reminding citizens that it was their duty to inform on Marxists and turn in the fugitive, or else they would be marked as traitors and brought to justice. Alba miraculously rescued Jaime's car, which had survived the bombing and had been sitting for a week where he had parked it. She painted 2 large sunflowers on the doors with the brightest yellow she could find to distinguish it from other cars and make her new job easier. She had to memorize the location of all the embassies, the shifts of the guardsmen who stood watch in front of them, the height of their walls and width of their doors. Word that someone needed asylum would reach her unexpectedly, often through a stranger who approached her on the street and who she imagined had been sent by Miguel. She would drive to the appointed place in broad daylight, and when she saw someone motioning to her, recognizing the yellow flowers on her car, she stopped for a minute to let the man jump in. They never spoke on the way, because she preferred not to know his name. There were times when she had to spend the whole day with him, or even hide him for a night or two, before finding the right moment to slip him into one of the more accessible embassies, climbing a wall behind the guard's back. This system turned out to be more reliable than working out complicated arrangements with the nervous ambassadors of the foreign democracies. She would never hear another word about the person she had helped, but she retained forever their trembling gratitude and once it was over, she breathed a sigh of relief that at least, this time, someone had been saved. Occasionally, she had to do the same thing with women who feared being separated from their children, and no matter how much Alba promised them that she would bring their children to them afterwards through the front door, knowing as she did that not even the most timid ambassador would turn her down, the mothers refused to leave their children behind, and even the children had to be thrown over the walls or slipped through the iron gates. Soon all the embassies were ringed with barbed wire and machine guns, and it was impossible to continue taking them by storm. But then there were other needs to keep her busy. It was Amanda who first put her in touch with the priests. The two friends would get together to whisper about Miguel, whom neither of them had seen, and to remember Jaime with dry-eyed yearning. There was no official proof that he had died, and their desire to see him again was stronger than the soldier's tale. Amanda had resumed her compulsive smoking. Her hands shook, and her gaze wandered. At times, her pupils were dilated and she moved slowly, but she continued working in the hospital. She told Alba that she frequently took care of patients who were faint with hunger. "The families of prisoners, disappeared people, and the dead have nothing to eat. The unemployed don't either, barely a plate of corn mush every other day. The children are so undernourished that they fall asleep in school." She added that the glass of milk and crackers that school children used to receive each day had been discontinued, and that mothers were quieting their children's hunger with cups of tea. "The only ones trying to help are the priests," Amanda said. "People don't want to know the truth. The church has organized soup kitchens to feed children under 7, a hot meal 6 times a week. Of course, that's not enough. For every child who eats a plate of lentils or potatoes once a day, there are 5 outside looking in because there's not enough to go around." Alba realized that they had returned to the old days when her grandmother Clara went to the Misericordia district to replace justice with charity. Except that now charity was frowned upon. She noticed that whenever she went to the houses of her friends to ask for a package of rice or a tin of powdered milk, no one dared to turn her down the first time, but afterward they avoided her. At first, Blanca helped her. Alba had no trouble obtaining the key to her mother's pantry, arguing that there was no need to hoard ordinary flour and poor men's beans when you could buy Baltic crab and Swiss chocolate. This enabled her to stock the priests' kitchens for a time, which, however, seemed all too brief to her. One day, she took her mother to one of the soup kitchens. When Blanca saw the long, unpolished wooden table where 2 rows of children were waiting their portions with pleading eyes, she began to cry and wound up spending 2 days with a splitting headache. She would have gone on crying if her daughter hadn't forced her to get dressed, forget about herself, and look for help, even if it meant she had to steal from her father's household budget. Senator Treva would not discuss the subject. Like everyone else in his class, he denied the existence of hunger just as vehemently as he denied that of the prisoners in torture. This meant that Alba could not rely on him, and later, when she could no longer rely on her mother either, she was forced to take more drastic measures. The farthest her grandfather went was to his club. He never went downtown, much less to the outskirts of the city or the shanty towns. It was no effort for him to believe that the misery his granddaughter reported was a Marxist fabrication. "Communist priests," he shouted. "That's the last thing I need to hear." But when children and women began to appear outside people's houses at every hour of the day and night, begging for something to eat, Treva, instead of ordering the gates to be shut and lowering the blinds so he wouldn't have to see them, like everyone else, raised Blanca's monthly stipend and said there should always be hot food on hand to give away. "This is just a temporary situation," he assured them. "As soon as the military can straighten out the chaos that the Marxists left the country in, this kind of problem will be resolved." The newspapers said that the beggars in the streets, a sight that had not been seen in years, had been sent by international communism to discredit the military junta and undermine the return to order and progress. Cement walls were erected to hide the most unsightly shantytowns from the eyes of tourists and others who preferred not to see them. In a single night, as if by magic, beautifully pruned gardens and flower beds appeared on the avenues. They had been planted by the unemployed to create the illusion of a peaceful spring. White paint was used to erase the murals of doves and to remove all political posters from sight. Any attempt to write political messages in public was punished with a burst of machine gun fire on the spot. The clean, orderly, silent streets were reopened to commerce. Soon the beggar children disappeared, and Alba noticed that the stray dogs and piles of garbage were gone too. The black market came to an end at the very moment when the presidential palace was bombed because speculators were threatened with martial law and execution by firing squad. Items whose very name was unheard of began to be sold in stores, along with things that only the rich had previously been able to buy as contraband. The city had never looked more beautiful. The upper middle class had never been so happy. They could buy as much whiskey as they wanted, and automobiles on credit. In the patriotic euphoria of the first few days, women brought their jewels to the barracks to help finance the national reconstruction. They even handed over their wedding rings, which were replaced with copper bands that bore the national seal. Blanca had to hide the woolen stocking that contained the jewels Clara had left her, to prevent Senator Trueba from handing them over to the authorities. They saw the birth of a proud new class, illustrious ladies dressed in foreign clothes, as exotic and shimmering as fireflies, paraded themselves in the fashionable entertainment centers on the arm of the proud new economists. A caste of military men arose to fill key posts. Families who had previously considered it a disgrace to count a member of the military among their number were now pitted against each other in the struggle to see who could get their sons into the war academies and were offering their daughters to soldiers. The country, filled with men in uniform, with war machines, flags, hymns, and parades, because the military understood the need for the people to have their own rituals and symbols. Senator Trueba, who despised these things on principle, realized what his friends at the club had meant when they had assured him that Marxism did not stand a chance in Latin America because it did not allow for the magical side of things. Bread, circuses, and something to worship are all they need, the senator concluded, regretting in his conscience that there should be a lack of bread. A campaign was orchestrated to erase from the face of the earth the good name of the former president, in the hope that the masses would stop mourning him. His house was opened, and the public was invited to visit what they called the dictator's palace. People could look into his closets and marvel at the quantity and quality of his suede jackets, go through his drawers, and rummage in his pantry to see the Cuban rum and bag of sugar he had put away. The most crudely touched-up photographs were circulated, depicting him dressed as Bacchus with a garland of grapes around his head, cavorting with opulent matrons and athletes of his own sex in a perpetual orgy. No one, not even Senator Trueba, believed they were authentic. "This is too much. This time they've gone too far," he muttered when he saw them. With a stroke of the pen, the military changed world history, erasing every incident, ideology, and historical figure of which the regime disapproved. They adjusted the maps because there was no reason why the North should be placed on top, so far away from their beloved fatherland, when it could be placed on the bottom, where it would appear in a more favorable light. And while they were at it, they painted vast areas of Prussian blue territorial waters that stretched all the way to Africa and Asia, and appropriated distant countries in the geography books, leaping borders with impunity until the neighboring countries lost their patience, sought help from the United Nations, and threatened to send in tanks and planes. Censorship, which at first covered only the mass media, was soon extended to textbooks, song lyrics, movie scripts, and even private conversation. There were words prohibited by military decree, such as the word compañero, and other words that could not be mentioned even though no edict had swept them from the lexicon, such as freedom, justice, and trade union. Alba wondered where so many fascists had come from overnight, because in the country's long democratic history, they had not been particularly noticeable, except for a few who got carried away during World War II and thought it amusing to parade in black shirts with their arms raised in salute, to the laughter and hissing of bystanders, and had never won any important role in the life of the country. Nor did she understand the attitude of the armed forces, most of whom came from the middle and working class and had traditionally been closer to the left than to the far right. She did not understand the state of civil war, nor did she realize that war is the soldiers' work of art, the culmination of all their training, the gold medal of their profession. Soldiers are not made to shine in times of peace. The coup gave them a chance to put into practice what they had learned in their barracks. Blind obedience, the use of arms, and other skills that soldiers can master once they silence the scruples of their hearts. Alba abandoned her studies, the school of philosophy, like many others that opened the gateway of the mind, was closed. Nor did she continue with her music, because her cello seemed frivolous to her under the circumstances. Many professors were fired, arrested, or simply disappeared in accordance with a black list in the hands of the political police. Sebastián Gómez was killed in the first raid, betrayed by his own students. The university was filled with spies. The upper middle class and the economic right, who had favored the coup, were euphoric. At first, they were a little shocked when they saw the consequences of their action. They had never lived in a dictatorship and did not know what it was like. They thought the loss of democratic freedoms would be temporary and that it was possible to go without individual or collective rights for a while, so long as the regime respected the tenets of free enterprise. Nor did they put much stock on international condemnation, which lumped them in the same category as the other tyrannies of the region, because it seemed a small price to pay for the defeat of Marxism. When foreign investment capital began to flow into the country, they naturally attributed it to the stability of the new regime, ignoring the fact that for every peso that entered the country, two were lost to interest. When almost all the national industries were gradually shut down, and businesses were beginning to go bankrupt, defeated by the massive importation of consumer goods, they said that Brazilian stoves, Taiwanese cloth, and Japanese motorcycles were superior to anything that had ever been manufactured in the country. Only when the concessions of the mines were returned to the North American companies after 3 years of nationalization did a few voices suggest that this amounted to giving the country away wrapped in cellophane. But when the lands that the agrarian reform had parceled out were returned to their former owners, they were reassured. Things were returning to the good old days. They realized that only a dictatorship could act with the necessary force and without accounting to the people to guarantee their privileges, so they stopped talking about politics and accepted the idea that they held economic power. But the military was going to rule. The right's only task was to advise the military in the elaboration of new edicts and new laws. Within days, they had eliminated labor unions. The union leaders were either in jail or dead. Political parties had been indefinitely recessed. And all student worker organizations and even professional associations had been dismantled. Gatherings of any size were forbidden. The only place people could congregate was in church, so religion quickly became fashionable, and priests and nuns were forced to postpone their spiritual tasks in order to minister to the earthly needs of their lost flocks. The government and the business community began to view them as potential enemies, and some dreamt of resolving the problem by assassinating the cardinal. When it was clear that the Pope in Rome had no intention of removing him from his post and sending him to an asylum for insane priests. A large part of the middle class rejoiced at the military coup, because to them it signaled a return to law and order, to the beauty of tradition, skirts for women and short hair for men. But they soon began to suffer from the impact of high prices and the lack of jobs. Their salaries were not sufficient to buy food. There was someone to mourn for in every family, and the middle class could no longer say, as they had in the beginning, that if he was imprisoned, dead or exiled, it was because he deserved it. Nor could they go on denying the use of torture. While luxury stores, miraculous finance companies, exotic restaurants, and import businesses were flourishing, the unemployed lined up outside factory gates, waiting for a chance to work at the minimum wage. The labor force was reduced to slavery, and for the first time in many decades, management was able to fire people at will without granting any severance pay, and to have them thrown in jail for the slightest protest. During the first months, Senator Trueba shared the opportunism of his class. He was convinced that a period of dictatorship was necessary to bring the country back into the fold it never should have left. He was one of the first landowners to regain his land. Tres Marias was returned to him in ruins, but intact down to the last square yard. He had waited more than 2 years for this moment, nursing his anger. Without giving it a second thought, he left for the countryside with half a dozen hired thugs to avenge himself to his heart's content against the peasants who had dared to defy him and rob him of his property. They arrived on a fine Sunday morning, shortly before Christmas, entering the hacienda with all the clamor of a pirate crew. His men spread out, rounding people up with curses, blows, and kicks. Then they gathered humans and animals in the courtyard, poured gasoline on the little brick houses that had once been Trueba's pride and joy, and set fire to them and everything inside them. They shot the animals to death. They burned the fields, the chicken coops, the bicycles, and even the cradles of newborn babies in a noontime witch's Sabbath that nearly made Trueba die of joy. He dismissed all the tenants, warning them that if he ever caught them prowling around his property, they would suffer the same fate as their animals. He watched them depart poorer than ever in a long, sad procession, with their children, their old people, and the few dogs that had survived the shooting, and some chickens saved from the inferno, dragging their feet along the dusty road that led away from the land where they had lived for generations. At the gate to Tres Marias, there was a group of wretched people waiting with anxious eyes. They were peasants who had also been expelled from their hacienda, arriving as humbly as their ancestors of the preceding century to beg the patron to give them work in the coming harvest. That night, Esteban Trueba lay down in the iron bed that had belonged to his parents, in the old main house where he had not slept in years. He was tired. The smell of the fire, and the animals that had had to be burned so that their rotting corpses would not infect the air, clung to his nostrils. The remains of the little houses were still burning. Everywhere around him was death and destruction. But he knew that he could restore the land again, just as he had once before, because the pastures were intact, and so was his strength. Despite the pleasure of his revenge, he was unable to sleep. He felt like a father who has punished his children too severely. All that night, he kept recalling the faces of the peasants, whom he had seen come into this world on his property, as they moved off along the highway. He cursed his bad temper. Nor was he able to sleep well the rest of that week, and when he finally did, he dreamt of Rosa. He decided not to tell anyone what he had done, and promised himself that Tres Marias would again become the model farm it had once been,
He let it be known that he was willing to have his tenants back, under certain conditions, of course, but none of them returned. They had scattered throughout the countryside, across the mountains and along the coast. Some had walked all the way to the mines, others to the islands of the south, all of them seeking their family's daily bread wherever they could find it. Disgusted with himself, the patron returned to the city, feeling older than ever. His soul weighed heavy. The poet was dying in his house by the sea. He had been ailing, and the recent events had exhausted his desire to go on living. Soldiers broke into his house, ransacked his snail collection, his shells, his butterflies, his bottles, the ship figureheads he had rescued from so many seas, his books, his paintings, and his unfinished poems, looking for subversive weapons and hidden communists, until his old poet's heart began to falter. They took him to the capital, where he died 4 days later. The last words of this man who had sung to life were, "They're going to shoot them. They're going to shoot them." Not one of his friends could be with him at the hour of his death. They were all outlaws, fugitives, exiles, or dead. His blue house on the hill lay half in ruins, its floor burnt, and its windows broken. No one knew if it was the work of the military, as the neighbors said, or of the neighbors, as the military said. A wake was held by those few who were brave enough to attend, along with journalists from all over the world who came to cover his funeral. Senator Trueba was his ideological enemy, but he had often had him in his house and knew his poetry by heart. He appeared at the wake dressed in rigorous black with his granddaughter Alba. Both stood watch beside the simple wooden coffin and accompanied it to the cemetery on that unfortunate morning. Alba was holding a bouquet of the first carnations of the season, as red as blood. The small cortege walked on foot, slowly, all the way to the cemetery, between two rows of soldiers who had cordoned off the streets. People went in silence. Suddenly, someone hoarsely called out the poet's name, and in a single voice everyone replied, "Here, now, and forever." It was as if they had opened a valve, and all the pain, fear, and anger of those days had issued from their chests and rolled onto the street, rising in a terrible shout to the thick black clouds above. Another shouted, "Compañero President!" And everyone answered in a single wail, the way men grieve, "Here, now, and forever." The poet's funeral had turned into the symbolic burial of freedom. The cameramen of Swedish television were filming close by Alba and her grandfather to send back to Nobel's frozen land the terrifying image of machine guns posted on both sides of the street, people's faces, the flower-covered coffin, as well as the silent group of women clustered in the doorway of the morgue, 2 blocks from the cemetery, reading the names on the lists of dead. Voices mingled in a single chant, and the air filled with forbidden slogans as, face to face with the guns that were shaking in the soldiers' hands, they shouted that the people united would never be defeated. The cortege passed in front of a construction site, and the workers dropped their tools, removed their helmets, and, with bowed heads, formed a single line. A man with a shirt frayed at the cuffs, without a jacket, and wearing broken shoes, marched along reciting the poet's most revolutionary poems, his grief streaming down his face. Senator Trueba gazed at him in astonishment. "It's a shame he was a communist," the senator told his granddaughter. "Such a fine poet, and such confused ideas. If he had died before the coup, I suppose he would have received a national tribute." "He knew how to die, just as he knew how to live, grandfather," Alba replied. She was convinced that he had died at the proper time, because no tribute
could have been any greater than this modest procession of a handful of men and women who lowered him into a borrowed grave, shouting his verses of freedom and justice for the last time. 2 days later, a notice from the military junta appeared in the papers, decreeing national mourning for the poet and authorizing those who wanted to do so to fly the flag at half-mast in front of their houses. The permission was valid from the moment of his death until the day the notice appeared. In the same way that she could not sit down to mourn her uncle Jaime, Alba could not lose her head thinking of Miguel or grieving for the poet. She was absorbed in the task of tracking down the disappeared, comforting the victims of torture who returned with their backs flayed and their eyes unfocused, and searching for food for the priests' soup kitchens. Still, in the silence of the night, when the city lost its stage-set normality and operetta peace, she was besieged by the agonizing thoughts she had repressed during the day. At that time of night, the only traffic consisted of trucks filled with bodies and detainees, and police cars that roamed the streets like lost wolves howling in the darkness of the curfew. Alba shook in her bed. She saw the ghosts of all those unknown dead, heard the great house pant with the labored breath of an old woman. Her hearing sharpened, and she felt the dreadful noises in her bones, a distant screeching of brakes, the slam of a door, gunfire, the crush of boots, a muffled scream. Then the long silence would return, lasting until dawn, when the city reawakened and the sun seemed to erase the terrors of the night. She was not the only one in the house who lay awake at night. She often came upon her grandfather in his nightshirt and slippers, older and sadder than during the day, heating up a cup of bouillon and muttering the curses of a buccaneer because his bones and his soul were killing him. Her mother also rummaged in the kitchen or walked like some midnight apparition through the empty rooms. Thus, the months went by, and it became clear to everyone, even Senator Trueba, that the military had seized power to keep it for themselves and not to hand the country over to the politicians of the right who had made the coup possible. The military were a breed apart, brothers who spoke a different dialect from the civilians, and with whom any attempt at dialogue would be a conversation of the deaf, because the slightest dissent was considered treason in their rigid honor code. Trueba realized that they had messianic plans that did not include the politicians. One day he was discussing the situation with Blanca and Alba. He expressed his regret that the army's action, whose purpose had been to eliminate the threat of a Marxist dictatorship, had condemned the country to a dictatorship far more severe, one that, to all evidence, was fated to last a century. For the first time in his life, Senator Trueba admitted he had made a mistake. Sunk in his armchair like an old man at the end of his days, they saw him shed silent tears. He was not crying because he had lost power. He was crying for his country. Then Blanca knelt beside him and took his hand. She confessed that Pedro III was living like a hermit in one of the abandoned rooms Clara had built in the time of the spirits. The day after the coup, the lists of people who were supposed to present themselves to the authorities had been published, and the name of Pedro III Garcia was among them. There were some who, convinced that in their country nothing like this could ever happen, had gone on their own to surrender to the Ministry of Defense, and had paid for it with their lives. But Pedro III had had a premonition of the ferocity of the new regime long before anyone else, perhaps because during those 3 years he had come to know the armed forces and no longer believed that they were any different from those elsewhere in the world. That same night, while the curfew was in force, he had crawled to the big house on the corner and knocked at Blanca's window. When she looked out, her eyes blurred from her migraine, she did not recognize him, because he had shaved his beard and was wearing spectacles.
"They've killed the president," Pedro III said. She hid him.